NPHET will meet today to discuss what advice to give government on easing restrictions next week. And then later today, the powerful Cabinet subcommittee will meet to consider NPHET's advice. That committee, made up of the three coalition leaders and a number of senior ministers, is expected to recommend a full return of construction, the reopening of personal services like hairdressing, as well as a phased return of non-essential retail on a click-and-collect basis. In-person religious services are expected to be allowed to restart, as is outdoor sports training for the over-18s and the possible reopening of museums, galleries and libraries. Further reopening is dependent on case numbers. They were at 426 last night, plus 10 deaths. Hospital numbers and progress on vaccination. Well, there have been a number of changes to that vaccination programme announced in the last 24 hours. We'll go through them with Fergal Bowers in a moment, but first, speaking on RTE's primetime last night, the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, said it was unlikely that people would be able to choose what vaccine they get.
All of the vaccines have now been deemed appropriate and safe and highly effective for everyone aged 50 and over, which is fantastic news that we got today. It means that we can keep going at pace with the vaccine programme. And to your question, will there be a choice? It's not envisaged there would be a choice. And it's not because we wouldn't want to give one. We'd love to have as many vaccines and different types of vaccines as possible to let anybody choose what they want. But the reality is we've got to keep the vaccine programme moving at a pace that gets the country vaccinated as quickly as possible.
If you've registered for AstraZeneca in the 60 to 69 year old age group, if you've already registered for AstraZeneca, you cannot now change your mind and go to Johnson & Johnson.
So the operational details of exactly how AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson will be distributed from 50 up are things the HSE are working out right now. But certainly at the moment, it wouldn't be envisaged that there'd be a choice. But what we do see is both vaccines being used for those age groups.
That's Stephen Donnelly talking to Sarah McInerney on RTE's Primetime last night. Well, Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines, they're going to be used only in the over 50s, with some exceptions. Pfizer and Moderna are being used for the over 70s, who should have their vaccinations fully completed by the middle of May. At the moment, these two mRNA vaccines will be used for the 18 to 49 age groups as well. There are other changes too. We're joined by our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. Fergal, good morning. One of the changes, pregnant women will get vaccinated now.
Yes, the recommendation is that pregnant women get vaccinated between 14 and 36 weeks gestation with the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, so they're the mRNA vaccines, and that's after a discussion with their obstetric specialist on their risks and benefits. And the 14 to 36 weeks have both doses administered is viewed as the best window when the vaccination should be offered, given that pregnancy is a time-sensitive condition, NIAC says. And NIAC says that pregnant women are at similar risk of COVID-19 infection to non-pregnant women of the same age, that the overall risk of severe illness in pregnancy is very low, and that there's no evidence that the COVID-19 vaccine affects fertility or the fetus.
Okay. Now, Fergal, they also announced that anyone who has had COVID, the virus, and who is under the age of 50 can just be satisfied with one dose of a vaccine. But those who've had the virus and who are over 50 need two doses of the vaccine. Why?
Yes, some people under 50 years of age, they're going to get just one dose of an mRNA vaccine, you know, Pfizer or Moderna, and they'll be considered fully vaccinated under this revised government vaccination plan agreed by Cabinet. So it'll apply to people who had a laboratory-confirmed COVID-19 determination in the previous 6 months and who are not immunocompromised. And NIAC and the government say it's based on evidence regarding the immune response for people under 50 who had COVID-19, showing that a second mRNA dose doesn't appear to increase the immune response. The people who are over 50 will get their second dose, as this group appears to have a less robust immune response. And that's what's going to happen in terms of the programme from here on in.
Okay. And in relation to the vaccination programme as it is now, we were told that the over 70s should all be finished, two doses by the middle of May. So if that is proceeding, then they're almost done. The AstraZeneca is being given to the 60 to 69 age group. That's underway. The Johnson & Johnson then for the 50 to 59 age group, is that going to start now in parallel with the J&J supplies that are already in the country?
Well, the agency will be working through the logistics of this. I think we'll hear more from them tomorrow when they give their briefing as to the implications of the changes in the plan. I mean, there have been so many changes coming thick and fast at people, people who run the service and also the public. It's all very difficult to absorb and it's quite complex. But the hope is that it will mean more vaccines for more people. So the registration for people 60 to 69, I mean, that has fully opened using AstraZeneca, and I think over 250,000 people, you know, have registered in that category at this point. So, as you say, the next group will be 50 to 59. We're waiting to hear when registration will start in that group. I think the latest developments will mean that they likely get the Johnson & Johnson single dose vaccine. That should start shortly, and then we'd move to the 40 to 49 year age group. And there are about 2.5 million doses of Pfizer and Moderna due here between now and June. So it's hard to see a shortage of vaccines now for the various age groupings, given what's happened at this point.
Yeah, it's a lot of vaccines coming in, all right. But are there enough vaccinators?
Well, the HSC has said that it has enough vaccinators. Recent figures at a health committee was over 1,500, and more will be added if needed. But I have seen reports, individual reports from people of, you know, long waiting times, maybe an hour, even an hour and a half or more outside some of the mass vaccination centres in Dublin and Limerick. And, you know, many of these people are older people. They have to stand outside in the open air, rain, wind, cold, sun. That's not easy. And some people have complained they feel it's down to maybe there aren't enough vaccinators inside in the centres to process people quickly enough. But the HSC insists it has sufficient vaccinators. But I suppose that's an issue of people having to wait very long periods. In whatever the weather is, it's not easy to be standing.
And just finally, Fergal, as all these bodies prepare to meet today with the aim of reopening society, reopening the economy as the weeks and months go on, that full reopening presumably dependent on acquired immunity within the population. So that target of 80% of first doses delivered by the end of June, that's still the aim. Is it still achievable?
Well, the vaccination plan target for April was that in April, the month of April, that the HSC would do 860,000 vaccinations. But yesterday, Minister Donnelly said that April is looking more likely at about 700,000 or so vaccinations. So, you know, that's significantly less. So we're missing targets, and we're consistently missing targets. And the hope is that the latest changes will result in faster vaccination for people. No one has said in government that the target of having over 80% of people getting their first dose of vaccine by the end of June will not be met. And I suppose it's a fundamental target. The full reopening of society is obviously heavily dependent on widespread population immunity. But the significant easing and further easing of restrictions, probably more dependent on, you know, significant number of the population getting their first dose of vaccine. So it's a crucial target.
Absolutely. Fergal, great to talk to you again. Thank you very much. Fergal Bowers, our health correspondent.
After more than 5 years as DUP leader, Arlene Foster's time at the helm appears to be coming to a close after 75% of her MLAs signed a letter calling for a leadership contest. They no longer have confidence in her leadership. She's under pressure to make a statement about her intentions today. With more, I'm joined by our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney. Vincent, you were saying yourself earlier, it appears to be a question of when and not if, but it is the speed of the takedown of Arlene Foster, if this is what is to happen, that's so striking here. How has this coup been organised?
Well, Obviously, organised very, very well and very quietly as well, because there have been rumblings for some time now about discontent with Arlene Foster's leadership. She was given a lot to think about last night when she went home to her husband and three children to discuss her future. We understand she wanted to sleep in the matter, because obviously this has come as quite a shock to her. Because yesterday afternoon, out in the streets of Belfast, it was put to her that there were reports that her leadership was under real pressure. And she almost shrugged her shoulders and was nearly quite dismissive and pointed out that there had been talk of previous leadership challenges that had come to nothing. I said, look, we just need to get on with it. I have bigger things to do here, like steer us through this COVID pandemic. Because yesterday morning there had been reports in the Belfast newsletter, a unionist morning newspaper, saying that there was open revolt against her, with eight of the party's 18 constituency associations writing to the party chairman expressing no confidence in her. But that quickly grew with news in the afternoon that MLAs and MPs from the party had also signed a letter of no confidence. The understanding now, Mary, is that at least 22, we're told, MLAs have possibly signed that letter from a total of 28, and half of the MPs at Westminster, 4 out of 8. And this, so the timing has been a real surprise. As I said, there was discontent around Arlene Foster. We knew that for some time. She has looked like someone who was feeling the strain, feeling the stress and the pressure for some time. But this has caught her by surprise and caught her very small number of supporters by surprise as well. So obviously those who plotted this did so over a lengthy period, but managed to keep it very quiet. And even yesterday when news started to break, there was clearly an understanding between them all, because suddenly phones that are normally very receptive were all turned off. Any calls that were made were getting that automatic response that's generated, sorry, I can't talk now. So it's now over to Arlene Foster, who said she's under pressure to say something today.
Okay, will you take us through the next steps? I mean, politics is a tough business. If the numbers aren't there and it is the end for Arlene Foster, do they give her time and space, or is this going to be short and sharp?
That will depend on just how, I suppose, cruel in some ways that the critics wish to be, because we're wondering today, does Arlene Foster announce that she's going to contest the election? That's one option. Now, given the numbers stacked against her, Mary, she would have said need to be a political Houdini to escape this one. It's hard to see her contesting the numbers when so many of the party are clearly against her. So what happens next? Well, she could step down as both DUP leader and First Minister. Perhaps she might be given time and a caretaker role. While the leadership context takes place, she could perhaps stay on as First Minister to give a bit of stability. Because what happens, Marie, is when she steps down as First Minister, under the rules of Stormont, the DUP will have 7 days to nominate someone else to take her place. Now, if they don't nominate someone for any reason, say, for example, as part of a campaign to extract concessions from the British government on the Northern Ireland Protocol, if they don't get what they want in the protocol and they decide not to nominate someone to replace Arlene Foster, the Stormont executive automatically falls. The Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, would have to call an election. If you remember, Mary, that's what happened back in 2017 and the row over the RHI scheme, the so-called Cash for Ice scheme. Martin McGuinness announced his intention to resign as Deputy First Minister and did not nominate someone to take his place. And by triggering that mechanism, the Stormont executive fell.
Okay.
So potentially we could be facing into an election, a wider election, not just the election of a new DUP leader.
Vincent, a final brief word on who is coming through to replace her, the likely names.
Some names have been bandied about, Mary. It looks like the party might go for a split leadership option with someone leading from Westminster and the First Minister. So Westminster, names like Geoffrey Donaldson and Gavin Robinson, the East Belfast MP, are being tipped as possible leaders. In terms of at Stormont, Edwin Poots is a name on many people's lips. Now, Edwin Poots is the current Minister for Agriculture. He's taken a very hard-line approach in the protocol, a very outspoken critic. And interestingly, Edwin Poots is today due to take part in a North-South Ministerial Council meeting to discuss agricultural issues. Now, I would say if he does not attend that meeting, that's probably a fairly clear indication that his hat is in the ring. Because if he does attend, it will draw huge criticism from hardliners within
his
own party.
All right. More on this story from you throughout the course of the day, Vincent. We'll have more on this programme as well.
We hadn't seen excitement like it in months. The prospect of an election, a by-election no less, all the drama. How will it work during a pandemic? Who will run? Who will win? So many questions prompted by the resignation of Fine Gael TD for Dublin Bay South, Owen Murphy. Fiacra O'Kiona reports.
It's always been a really colourful constituency. It's always very lively. I think that this will be a by-election that will be very, very closely watched.
Owen Murphy's resignation as a Fine Gael TD means the constituency now faces a by-election before November. And with party and personal futures at stake, political commentator Lise Hand says the upcoming bout has all the makings of another epic political dust-up.
It's a fairly well-got constituency, really. A lot of leafy suburbs. It's probably best known, though, for the rumble in Ranelagh, when bitter constituency rivals, PD leader Michael McDougall and then Green Party leader John Gormley, had a couple of very famous set twos. Big row broke out between them in the triangle in Ranelagh.
While voters are watching politicians, politicians will be watching local issues. But unlike some constituencies, in Dublin Bay South, no single issue will be the knockout punch.
Locally here, there's the big issue around the cycle lane out on the Sandyman Strand.
During the pandemic, social gatherings like what we've had in Portobello over the weekend, horrendous scenes after. They're destroying everybody's lives.
Homelessness is at the top, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's absolutely appalling. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, there are tents on the canal again.
Yeah. And I agree, because what hope have they got?
And there are all these apartments flying up all over the place, which even people that have two jobs, they can't afford to get a mortgage. Mm-hmm.
There's so many people, like, all overcrowded in flats, and there's apartments and all getting built that should have been more affordable, the same way. Down at the Barrow Street end, Boland's Mill, they were supposed to give a certain amount of social and affordable housing, and they didn't.
For politicians, it means a political campaign headache. Any candidate will have to decide which areas to focus on. But while they are making up their minds, so are voters.
Kate O'Connell would probably be one of the favourites at this stage. She wasn't that far off in the last election, so I'd say she'd be one of the forerunners.
But I heard, is it Ivana... that I think she's interested in that, and I think she would be excellent.
I think Sinn Féin might have a good chance. I think maybe people are tired of this government and think it's, and their plans seem to be same old, same old.
And if it wasn't already complicated enough, Dublin Bay South has a further layer of intrigue, with many potential candidates facing real competition, not just outside their parties, but inside them as well. Lise Hand says Fine Gael is a prime example.
It's going to be fascinating politically, because one would say the obvious candidate for Fine Gael would be Kate O'Connell. But Kate O'Connell would not be seen as an ally of Leo Varadkar. Local candidate James Gagan would be much more seen in the Leo Varadkar mould.
So too are the Greens and Dublin Mayor Hazel Chew.
It was felt by many party members that she should have been on the shared ticket with the party leader Eamon Ryan last time and wasn't, and that led to a lot of bad blood. The blood has got even badder since, as we've seen over the shenanigans over the Shannon elections, and it could get very messy. Maybe if the doors were closed to her, she might decide to have a solo run as an independent.
Fianna Fáil is also one to watch.
Yeah, Jim O'Callaghan might be in a bit of a bind, because if they run a good, strong candidate who does very well, that'll be good for him, but it might spell trouble then next time out if the Fianna Fáil vote, which is never particularly strong here, were to recede even further. And if they run somebody and it's a total disaster, that's not great for them either.
And other parties have their own dilemmas.
I think that Labour would actually feel that they're in with a shout on this one. And Sinn Féin, well, whether there's a second Sinn Féin seat is extremely dubious, and I think it would be highly unlikely. I know there has been some talk about Lynn Boylan, but she lives in Dublin Midwest. By-elections are about local issues.
There is a real possibility almost all candidates who ultimately run will be women.
There is a slim chance that every candidate in this by-election would be a woman. I think it would make for an absolutely fascinating contest.
All of which means, after a year of pandemic politics, the Dublin Bay South by-election promises a return to some good, old-fashioned political drama.
I mean, I kind of hope that we'd have a, you know, Shemozzle in Sandymount or a Ructions in Ringsend to kind of batch up with the rumble in Ranelagh. I think it's going to be fascinating, and I think for people who are a bit starved of politics over the last while, I think it'll be a bit of a spectator sport as well.
Lise Hand ending that report by Fiacra O'Kyonna.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 7.37, it's good morning to Damien O'Mara.
Audrey, good morning to you. It's soccer to start, where Chelsea will carry an away goal into the second leg of their UEFA Champions League semi-final after drawing 1-1 with Real Madrid last night. Christian Pulisic gave them the lead in the 14th minute in Spain. That was then cancelled out by Real's Karim Benzema 15 minutes later. The sides will play the return leg this day week at Stamford Bridge. So do Chelsea hold a significant advantage? A question posed last night to their manager Thomas Tuchel.
I don't know, actually. I mean, I have the feeling that we should have won the first half, and we should have, and we deserve to win the first half, and we could have maybe decided this match very, very early, and in the first half an hour, where we were playing so strong. Second half was a bit of a tactical match, and you could feel that we only had 2 days in between two away games. Next week we have to face another challenge against Real Madrid. Will be a tough one because Champions League semi-final. Nothing is sure. Even if we had a win here, everything is possible. It's half-time, and we need to fight for every centimeter and for every advantage that we want to have. We need to fight and deserve it.
Paris Saint-Germain hosts Manchester City in the first leg of the second semi-final tonight. That game kicks off at 8 o'clock. Stan Kroenke, the majority shareholder at Arsenal, last night moved to refute suggestions that he's open to selling the club. Arsenal were amongst the six English Premier League clubs who last week withdrew from plans for the breakaway European Super League. Former players Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira earlier this week joined in a bid to buy the club, which is fronted by the Spotify founder Daniel Eake. There was a Grade 1 treble as part of a five-timer for Willie Mullins on the opening day of the Punchestown Festival yesterday. Chacon Pour-Soie justified favouritism in the Champions Chase. Colreevy was a surprise winner of the Champion Novice Chase, the eight-year-old's final race, with Echoes in the Rain first home in the Champion Novice hurdle. The Gold Cup is the standout of the three Grade 1 races up for decision today. The withdrawal through injury of the Henry de Bromhead-trained Manella Indo on Monday means now that just six horses will contest the race. Four of those trained by Willie Mullins, including the current favourite Al Boom Photo, will be joined at 8.35 by Sam Twiston-Davies, who rides the Paul Nicholls-trained Clan des Oboes today. Racing today starts at 3.40. There's coverage on RT2 television from 4 o'clock. The Leinster captain Jonathan Sexton has been ruled out of Sunday's Heineken Champions Cup semi-final against La Rochelle. Sexton will continue through the return-to-play protocols. He underwent a HIA during the quarter-final against Exeter 3 weeks ago. Gary Ringrose and James Ryan are both available for selection, having returned from injury against Munster last Saturday. La Rochelle are currently level on points with Toulouse at the top of the French top 14. The former Leinster forwards coach John O'Gibbs is their director of rugby. Former Irish out-half Ronan O'Gara is their head coach, and his former international teammate Devon Toner isn't surprised at how the Cork man has made the leap from playing to management.
He's paved a way for himself as a world-class coach, and he's gone and learned, and you can see by all the teams he's been with how great they've been going. I think he played my first test in 2010, and again I've been involved in different Ireland camps with him, and he's a great man, a great player, and obviously he's proven to be a great coach. So I think the players have a lot of faith in him, and yeah, more power to him.
That match is live as part of Sunday Sport here on Radio 1 this coming weekend. The Irish hockey squad were yesterday beaten 3-1 by Great Britain, Anna O'Flanagan scoring the Irish goal. The sides meet in the second of four non-capped matches at 6 o'clock this evening, both currently preparing for the Tokyo Olympics. And play continues in the quarterfinals of the World Snooker Championship today. Neil Robertson and Kyron Wilson tied 8 frames each ahead of the resumption of play at 10 o'clock. Mark Selby leads Mark Williams 6-2. Anthony McGill is 9-7 up on Stuart Bingham ahead of the afternoon session. Judd Trump and Sean Murphy are tied 4 frames apiece. All of those matches the best of 25. And more sports news to come after 8:30, and updates available as always on the RTE News app and also on the RTE Sport website.
Some sad news: an Irishman, Rory Young, and two Spanish journalists killed in Burkina Faso after an armed ambush on an anti-poaching patrol near a nature reserve. The Zambian-born Mr. Young was co-founder and president of the anti-poaching organisation Chengeta Wildlife, who said that he had dedicated his life to wildlife protection. We can talk now to Sam Mednick, who is an AP correspondent in Burkina Faso. Sam, what is known about this attack, which I think took place on Monday of this week? What happened?
Yes, yeah, so on Monday morning, as you said, three foreigners were killed and a Burkina-based soldier went missing during an anti-poaching patrol in the east of the country. So there were two Spanish journalists, David Berrien and Roberto Frail, as well as the Irish citizen Rory Young. and they were ambushed by jihadists. In the morning, they were going on the patrol to enter this park, and the soldiers that I spoke to said the fighting lasted several hours. They tried to protect the foreigners, they said, by creating a perimeter around them, but amid the chaos and when the fighting was over, they said they turned around and the foreigners were gone. And then yesterday, they were reported that they had been killed.
And you spoke to some of the soldiers, and they managed to escape.
Yes, the Burkina Bay soldiers, I spoke to two who had been wounded, and they had managed to escape. They said the fighting, they were outnumbered by the jihadists. It lasted several hours, but they managed to get away. But unfortunately, they didn't know where one of their colleagues was and also where the three foreigners were.
So the bodies of the three foreigners have not been recovered?
Not that has been reported, but they have been reported that they have been killed by the Spanish government and the Irish government, as well as Burkina Faso's government.
Okay. And why were the journalists there?
The journalists were doing a documentary about the anti-poaching efforts. The government had said. So they had been with the anti-poaching team for about a week, and they were filming their efforts and seeing what they were doing. And this was the first mission that this anti-poaching patrol was going on after training for 6 months to do these types of missions.
And Mr. Young, the Irishman Rory Young, was he based in Burkina Faso?
From my knowledge, I know he worked for the organization. I don't know if he was based here or if he came and went and did training. I'm not sure if he was based here full time.
Sure. What's the political situation in the country at the moment then, Sam? I mean, why did this attack take place? What's the context of it?
Well, the country has been overrun with a jihadist insurgency, jihadist linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State since about 2015. And there are parts of the country that are inaccessible. So the Sahel, the north and the east where this attack took place. And this area is known for jihadist groups operating there. Jihadist groups are also known to want to kidnap foreigners for ransom. So it's unclear the motive of this particular attack, but this area in general is quite volatile and very unpredictable.
Okay, many thanks indeed for talking to us this morning. Sab Mednick, who's a correspondent with the Associated Press News Agency in Burkina Faso.
Controversy continues to swirl around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Now the Labour Party has accused him of lying over who paid for renovations to his Downing Street flat and has called for an inquiry. Johnson is under intense scrutiny about the refurbishment of the flat above number 11 Downing Street after his former chief adviser Dominic Cummings claimed the Prime Minister had planned unethical, foolish and possibly illegal use of Conservative Party donors' money for the work. The Prime Minister is also under pressure over claims he said he would rather see bodies pile high than order a third coronavirus lockdown last year. For more, I'm joined by George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times. And George, we sometimes hear that euphemism being economic with the truth being employed about politicians and their doings. But here we have a prime minister being accused of lying. What are the implications for Boris Johnson?
Well, at the moment, quite serious, I would say, because we are in a very unusual situation. I mean, we used to sort of fairly rumbustious language being used at Westminster, but for the main opposition party to accuse the prime minister of lying over who paid for the refurbishment of his flat is quite an extraordinary thing. Something else which is quite extraordinary is that Boris Johnson categorically denied saying that he was prepared to see bodies piling up rather than have a third national lockdown. But nevertheless, that comment was reported as fact by the BBC, the national broadcaster. So you've essentially got the BBC by implication suggesting that the Prime Minister is lying as well. So this whole Omni scandal, if you like, which has many different facets, does come down to a question about the Prime Minister's integrity and probity.
We are talking in relation to the refurbishment of the flat of a sum less than, I think, £60,000. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, the thing is that the Prime Minister so far failed to give a convincing or any real explanation at all of how the money, how this refurbishment was paid for. Now, we know that he eventually paid for it, but the question is, did someone else put up the money originally? Did he receive a loan for this? And if he did, we don't know who that person is. And of course, in any democracy, you need to have a money trail to find out who politicians are beholden to. And the fact the Prime Minister has so far failed to explain that has meant the story is just running on and on. And again, it comes back to that question of, can you trust Boris Johnson?
Does it all come back here to that man, Dominic Cummings, a man now scorned and exacting revenge?
Well, he's certainly out for revenge, and it introduced a huge element of uncertainty for Boris Johnson. An extraordinary thing last week that Boris Johnson personally phoned three national newspaper editors to accuse Dominic Cummings of being behind a series of damaging leaks relating to him and the government. And that, of course, gave Dominic Cummings all the excuse he needed to unleash a volley of accusations against Boris Johnson. And there are more to come. And I think this is the big concern for Boris Johnson, really, that Dominic Cummings will be giving evidence to a select committee of MPs next month about the way the Prime Minister has conducted the COVID pandemic response. And Dominic Cummings' allies say that he has emails and he might even have sound recordings of some of the things that Boris Johnson said during that crisis. And I think that will be very worrying for the Prime Minister.
One wonders, could it get worse than a comment about bodies piling high? What has the Prime Minister said in relation to that comment? Has he denied it?
Yeah, he denied it outright. He said that it was rubbish. He hadn't said such a thing. And Downing Street continues to deny it. But as I mentioned earlier, the fact that, you know, this has been reported as a fact now by most media organisations shows this sort of complete breakdown in trust, really, between the media over here and some of the things that Boris Johnson has said. And of course, you know, Boris Johnson's reputation for telling the truth has been questioned many times before. He was sacked as a reporter by the Times for making up a quote. And of course, you'll remember very well during the Brexit campaign, there's a lot of criticism for the way he insisted that his Brexit deal wouldn't see a trade border erected in the Irish Sea, which of course is exactly what happened.
And while, you know, this is a political story now in Westminster, it is in all of the national newspapers, is it of concern to Tory voters? And that's key because you have midterms coming up and you have a by-election as well in which the Tories are hoping to do well and they're 10 points ahead in the polls.
Well, that's a really good question. I think that's the one thing that's prevented panic breaking out in the Conservative Party at the moment is the fact that they do have this strong opinion poll lead. And with these elections next Thursday, there is a chance for the Conservative Party to stick two fingers up to the media and say, look, the voters don't care about all this. It's a Westminster bubble bit of gossip. The voters don't care. What they do care about is that Boris Johnson's government has a very successful vaccine programme. The economy looks like it's starting to come back from the pandemic. And, you know, this is the big thing that, you know, it's easy to overlook with Boris Johnson, that he remains a very popular politician with many people out in the country. And for, you know, a government in midterm after 11 years in power to be, you know, 10 points ahead of the opposition party and potentially on course to win a parliamentary by-election in a seat like Hartlepool, which has been a Labour seat for as long as anyone can remember, it's an extraordinary thing.
Briefly, the Arlene Foster situation at the moment, it looks like she cannot continue as DUP leader. Could that potentially, and her successor, potentially pose another problem for Johnson?
Yes, it certainly could, because it's not been easy for Boris Johnson working with Arlene Foster over the Northern Ireland deal, the protocol. But the possibility of an even harder liner unionist taking over in Northern Ireland will complicate things. On the Northern Ireland protocol, there's been a lot of bad blood between the UK and the EU on this. But, you know, in recent weeks, we've seen the UK realising there's no alternative to the Northern Ireland protocol and therefore has been trying to rebuild bridges with Brussels. Now, if there's a hardline DUP leader in place in Northern Ireland, possibly with the DUP demanding that Boris Johnson takes a tougher line in those talks with the EU, then I think that makes life a lot more complicated for the Prime Minister, as if life wasn't complicated enough already for him.
George Parker of the Financial Times, thank you.
The closure of Joe Walsh Tours yesterday has highlighted the major challenges facing the firms that normally bring hundreds of thousands of tourists to and from the country each year. Most tour operators haven't had any trade for more than a year now, and there's little sign of that changing in the next few months at least. To get a better idea of what that means for the industry, I'm joined now by Ruth Andrews, Chief Executive of the Incoming Tour Operators Association of Ireland. Ruth, can we expect many more firms to follow Joe Walsh Tours in closing their doors for good in the coming months?
Good morning, Adam. Well, I certainly hope not, and obviously the industry are deeply saddened by the closure of JWT after 60 years of highly successful trading and a household brand in the Irish travel market. Needless to say, everybody's thoughts are with the Walsh family and the team there today. But, you know, like all in the travel, aviation and inbound travel trade sector, they've not been able to trade, as you've said, for 14 months due to the required government COVID restrictions. It certainly highlights the difficulties being experienced in our sector. And I suppose one of the greatest difficulties difficulties for them and the inbound tour operators that I represent, being solely dependent on international inbound tourism that accounts for 75% of Irish tourism's earnings, is the lack of a plan from government as to when international travel can recommence. And we would strongly urge the government in its reopening plan announcements tomorrow to include a time frame for the return of international travel, using the balanced plan provided by the aviation sector to the government 10 days ago. This would give certainty. It would give hope for many of those businesses to know when they can get back to trading their way out of this pandemic.
If there is a plan announced tomorrow, is it still too late for this year? And these trips tend to be booked well in advance of the departure date. So is 2021 is effectively gone for tour operators now?
No, not necessarily. And certainly not given that we are seeing pent-up demand, particularly for markets such as the UK and the United States, who are well ahead in their vaccine programmes. And indeed, we will have caught up due to the great news of AstraZeneca and the Janssen vaccine now being able to come into play. We'll meet our targets of 80% of the adult population being vaccinated, which is right on track with them. But what we do need to know now, because if we can tell people that they can book Ireland by quarter three with specific timeframes and dates in place, then we can actually secure business for later this year and get recovery started. And that's vitally important. So the message here is, give us a clear plan. Give us the opportunity to actually trade and secure those bookings now for that later date this year. And that will really help to start to secure 2022 as well. You're absolutely right. There are longer lead-in times. Ireland needs to get the positive message out there about how we are now controlling COVID, how we will have a strong vaccination programme, and the measurements that are in place in terms of the levels of hospitalisations totally coming down, ICU patients. It's all moving in the right direction. We need a positive message from government, and that time frame is vitally important so that we can tell customers now when they can travel in the future.
Briefly, a kind of separate issue that came up yesterday, JWT saying it had business interruption insurance but failed to reach an agreement with its insurer over that. To your knowledge, are there other operators facing the same challenge at the moment?
Yes, there are, and again, trying to get clarity and trying to get the insurance industry to respond to their commitments is hugely important. We are talking about businesses that haven't traded now for 14 months. Liquidity is a huge issue. We will need continued support as well from government, and that has been committed. There will be no cliff edge from the supports that have been made available, because it is going to take time for the industry to recover. So things like continuation of the EWSS, things like grant aid support being administered through Fáilte Ireland are going to be critical to our businesses being able to trade out of COVID.
Okay, Ruth Andrews, Chief Executive of the Incoming Tour Operators Association of Ireland.
Vaccination programme redrawn to accelerate rollout is the lead story for the Irish Times this morning. Above detail that the HSE is reworking its vaccination programme to include a more rapid rollout in the coming weeks, while senior government officials are finalising plans for the next phase of reopening, due to be unveiled tomorrow. And this next stage is on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, with the headline, Back on the Road in June. John Lee and Craig Hughes write that summer breaks in Ireland may be possible within weeks, with the Taoiseach expected to announce tomorrow that the inter-county travel ban will be lifted after the June bank holiday weekend. But what of Ireland's pubs? The Irish Daily Star reports on its front page that what it describes as Fianna Fáil party rebels told Taoiseach Micheál Martin last night that they're in favour of reopening all pubs and restaurants at the same time this summer. The paper reports that last night's Fianna Fáil parliamentary party meeting heard motions in support of the pubs, including one from Senator Timmy Dooley calling for a fair reopening of all hospitality businesses together. The paper also reports that the Taoiseach wouldn't be drawn on a date for reopening pubs indoors or outdoors, and he said that motions at parliamentary party meetings were not the right way to deal with these issues. Elsewhere on the front page, the Star leads with the charging yesterday of former Sinn Féin councillor Jonathan Dowdall with the murder of Kinahan gang member David Byrne at the Regency Hotel in 2016. Yesterday's funeral for Jenny Poole from Finglas is the lead story for the Irish Sun and gives the main front page photograph to the Irish Times. The 24-year-old mother of two was killed in her Dublin home earlier this month. Her brother Jason told mourners at the funeral that she was a mother like no other. Jenny's life was all about her kids, he said. In the Belfast Telegraph and the Irish News, the no-confidence motion in Arlene Foster's leadership of the DUP is the big story this morning. John Manley on page one of the Irish News reports that Ms Foster's leadership last night appeared to be entering its closing chapter as a letter of no-confidence gained majority support among MPs and MLAs. While Suzanne Breen in the Belfast Telegraph writes that DUP insiders have predicted that a change of leader could have sweeping repercussions at Stormont, with any successor axing key members of the current ministerial team. Owen Murphy's surprise departure from Dáil Éireann is covered widely, as too, of course, is the by-election triggered by his decision, with several papers speculating on who the runners and riders will be. And on the Irish Examiner's front page, Daniel McConnell and Paul Hosford report that the by-election will have to take place over 2 days to allow for social distancing under new laws to be approved by the Dáil before the summer. Elsewhere, there are lots of photographs in the papers today of Justice Minister Helen McEntee, who characterised her maternity leave arrangements as a sticking plaster. Ms McEntee's last day before taking up her 6 months of leave was yesterday. She said, "It's really important that women see other women in roles and positions being able to take maternity leave, being able to return to their jobs and return to the positions that they were working in before." And on page 5 of the Irish Independent, the story that research from Trinity Business School has found that commuting to work reduces productivity by draining mental energy, affecting our ability to fully focus on what we're doing when we finally arrive at work. Researchers suggest employers reduce draining commutes by allowing flexible working arrangements. They said that although commuting is an everyday experience for most people, its dynamic nature and implication for daily life in organisations have been largely overlooked.
Can 80% of people get their first vaccine dose by the end of June? Well, the answer will determine a lot, primarily the extent of the reopening of society and the economy for the summer months. It's hoped that changes to the vaccination programme because of the limited use of Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines to the over 50s will mean that the lower age groups will be inoculated more quickly. People who have had the virus and who are under 50 years old will only need one dose. Those in the same scenario but who are over 50 will need two. NIAC has also recommended that pregnant women be vaccinated, but it has not recommended any change in the four-week gap between Pfizer and Moderna doses. We can talk now about all of this to Kingston Mills Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College. Professor Mills, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the over 70s should be almost finished. At least mid-May was the target for that. Should they continue then giving AstraZeneca to the 60 to 69-year-olds and keep Johnson & Johnson for the 50 to 59-year-olds or refine that?
Well, I mean, I've been vocal about my, displeasure, put it that way, at the idea of only giving the AstraZeneca vaccine to 69-year-olds. I think this is still a vulnerable age group, and we know that the mRNA vaccines are more effective. So why are we not giving the most effective vaccines to a vulnerable age group? It doesn't make sense to me. I welcome the news that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is now going to be, given to people in Ireland, and the over 50s, again, it's the same issue, really. I mean, they've said that perhaps the Johnson & Johnson might also be given to the over 60s, but it's not clear to the over 60-year-olds, and I fall into that category myself. In fact, I'm due to get my vaccine today. It's not clear to us, would we be eligible to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The minister last night on the TV wasn't at all clear about that. So it seems like the 60 to 69-year-old are being shoehorned into getting the AstraZeneca vaccine without any choice, and I think most of us are not too pleased about it.
But you can't pick your vaccine. I mean,
no,
is that not fair enough?
We would expect the authorities to pick it for us and pick the right one for a vulnerable age group, and they don't seem to have done that. I think the other one, which I find very surprising, is that they've decided to have a gap of 12 to 16 weeks for the people who get the AstraZeneca vaccine. That means, again, the 60 to 9-year-olds are going to have to wait up to 4 months until they're fully vaccinated. And then somebody who's 49 could get a Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, be fully vaccinated in 4 weeks after that, and be able to do the things that the 69-year-olds won't be able to do. So that's, again, very unfair on the 69-year-old group.
And on could these vaccines just all be one dose? Is there much more protection afforded by two doses?
That's exactly the point. That next point I was going to make, and you made that point well, very well. So I think the evidence that somehow the AstraZeneca vaccine can be spread out across 16 weeks and the Pfizer and Moderna can't, there's absolutely no scientific evidence behind that whatsoever. We know that the antibody response with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines is stronger, if anything, than with the AstraZeneca vaccine. So why would you leave a gap of 12 to 16 weeks after the AstraZeneca vaccine and not after the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which start with a stronger response? So the strong response is going to maintain stronger for up to 12 or 16 weeks. So it makes a complete sense to leave the 12 to 16 week gap with the highly effective vaccines. The studies in the States showed that one dose of either of those two vaccines confers 80% protection against infection, never mind COVID-19 disease, it's probably closer to 100%. So why would you waste, if you like, a second dose of vaccine, which could be going into people that have had no vaccine, rather than giving two doses now and not waiting with those age groups as well? So I really don't understand the rationale.
I want to talk to you in relation to that, I suppose, following on for that, in terms of research that's out this morning by the English Public Health Agency, which shows that people who had the Pfizer or the AstraZeneca vaccine and who got the virus 3 weeks later, they were almost 50% less likely to transmit the virus in their household. And we know that households are a huge risk of infection. So that research, what lessons could be taken from that?
That's a very important. We know that all of the vaccines prevent COVID-19, and all of them probably prevent people from ending up in hospital, and that's brilliant. So the sooner we can get vaccine into as many people as possible, that's what that tells us. That's why the giving two doses rather than one now doesn't make sense. The other thing is that related to the breakthrough, as you call them, there are. No vaccine is 100% effective, so people are going to get infected that have had the vaccine. We've already had reports of that. And what in particular is happening, and there's a report that I just read this morning from the States that showed that people in Rockefeller University that have been vaccinated, all the breakthrough cases were with variants. So people have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated, had antibodies in their system, but they got infected. And the reason they got infected was they got infected with the variants of concern. Mm. So what that is telling us is that a lot of the breakthroughs can be coming from the variants, not from the original virus. And that's in line with what I've said and others have said in the past, that there's a serious concern about the vaccines in terms of not protecting against the variants of concern. And these include the South African, Brazilian, and now the Indian variant.
Okay.
So that's the biggest issue going forward. The vaccines are working really well against the regular virus and the UK variant, but they will not work as well against these other variants of concern.
So I wonder then, does that feed into my last question to you in terms of the just over 20% who have had their first dose and around 10% who've had both doses at this point in this country, in terms of them being able to do the things that they would have done pre-pandemic, is it still too early for that?
I think it's not. If we didn't have, if we can contain the absolutely not. I mean, if we contain the variants in Ireland and we have very small numbers of it right now, then, there's absolutely no reason why people can't, behave as if they're not going to get infected, because they should still socially distance and all of that. But certainly they're in a different situation than someone who hasn't been vaccinated. And in terms of travel, I mean, there's a lot of talk now about allowing people that have been vaccinated to travel to certainly to European countries on a travel passport or travel vaccine certificate or green card or whatever you want to call it. So there's merit in that. The only issue is that if those variants continue to increase, and we know that some countries in Europe, including the UK, have significant numbers of the variants, we have numbers of it here, and if we don't contain those variants, and we've heard that people in that have been quarantined, a significant number of those who have tested positive with the variants. So that speaks to the benefit of the quarantine in terms of containing those variants. But the problem is that we're only sequencing a small number of the viruses, so we don't actually know the numbers of variants that are in Ireland, and that's the biggest challenge going forward.
Thank you very much indeed. Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College.
Pregnant women are to be offered faster access to jabs after the Cabinet approved a series of recommendations from the National Immunisation Advisory Committee. The advice means that pregnant women will be prioritised to receive either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. Our reporter Amy Nirieva has been getting reaction from some expectant mothers to yesterday's announcement.
My name's Laura Coffey and I'm 25 weeks pregnant. I personally wouldn't be inclined to go for the vaccine, Amy. I think the messaging has been mixed. At the start, we were told no for pregnant people and now it's yes. And it's the unknown and the risk for the baby. If I wasn't pregnant and a vaccine was offered, I'd take it straight away for myself. But it's the unknown. If it harmed the baby in any way, that would be the concern for me.
I'm Shauna. I'm 30 weeks pregnant and I'm from Cork. I would be inclined to say yes to the vaccine and that I would take it. But I think I would need to hear from my consultant first before fully committing. So my gut says I should get the vaccine. But there's so much pressure on us while pregnant to make the right decision, because it wouldn't be just me it would be affecting. So I'm really feeling that weight today.
Amy Nirieva reporting there, and for more I'm joined by Dr. Cliona Murphy, who's chair of the Institute of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Murphy, good morning.
Hi Mary, thank you for having me on.
We heard the hesitancy, the reluctance and the worry, understandable worry from those pregnant women there. Is that what you are hearing too, and what do you say by way of response?
Yes, Mary, I've been ringing people in the last few days who qualify under Priority 7 for the vaccination and having very good conversations. Some people have their minds made up and are, you know, want to go and have to have the vaccine. Some have decided to put it off till after they deliver the baby. So not necessarily anti-vaccine as such, but just not at the right time for them. So there's a range of views there, but overall, I suppose there is more information there compared to a few months ago. So the recommendations have changed just as more information and more research has come out. So what needs to be considered is the risk of COVID-19 to the pregnant woman, and she has more things to think about than, you know, a non-pregnant person regarding the risk of the disease to herself, admission to hospital, ICU, and the small risk of placentitis. And also then her own personal circumstances. So for somebody who's working from home and isn't seeing many people, they may decide to defer the vaccination. But not everybody is in that position. So we know that pregnant women, you know, have kids to bring to creche, have other caring responsibilities, and, you know, some are finding it quite difficult to cocoon and would like the opportunity to have the vaccine.
So ultimately, Dr. Murphy, the expectant mother and her partner will have to decide when the facts are laid before them. Can you give a definitive advice? Can you say to a mother in that 14 to 36 week period, would you be saying, I recommend that you take this vaccine?
What I say to people as I give them the advice, and that's what you need to give them the information, so that's what everybody needs to do to have an informed decision. So what I say to people is that, look, at the beginning there weren't, you know, the studies that we would have wished for vaccinations. However, since then there's been 90,000 people in the United States have had mRNA vaccines. There's been follow-up of those. There's been no excess side effects or adverse incidents in pregnancy. Noted. In Israel, again, another 70,000 have been vaccinated. And in the last few months, we've seen countries change their recommendations as, you know, the disease has changed and its effect on pregnant women has changed in effect as well.
It's a very difficult decision, isn't it? Does it come down to this, though, the facts that have been gleaned so far? If a pregnant woman contracts COVID, what are her risks and the risks to her baby as against the risk if you get a vaccine?
Yes, I think so. And what we know is that from animal studies, there's no actual or theoretical risk that we know of these mRNA vaccines in pregnancy. We do know now some of the research is coming out showing they are as efficacious in pregnant women as in non-pregnant. There's also some encouraging evidence showing that antibodies are formed. The antibodies cross to the baby, and in fact, there may be some protection to the baby. So as an added benefit, we know there's no reason to avoid vaccination, for example, for breastfeeding mothers, and again, there's the added benefit for babies. So there's more reassuring evidence coming out than not, if you like.
But are you saying that for a mother, for an expectant mother who is working from home and is able to control her contact outside of the home, is she better off staying vaccine free?
I wouldn't say she's better off. I would say that's a choice. And again, it is a choice we were looking for, if you like, and that has been provided by the government, because pregnancy is a very time limited situation, and to wait until the age rollout, it didn't seem quite fair to those who wanted the vaccine. So, I mean, it is a choice. There should be a conversation. But now there's more and more evidence saying it is a safe choice. The European Society of Teratology has come out with a position statement saying vaccination is the best protection for pregnant women. And a number of professional societies are coming out to say that as well. So, we are we're feeling, more confident about the safety and the efficacy of the vaccines in pregnant women, and we're continuing to watch the evidence.
Dr. Kalina Murphy, thank you very much. 27 minutes.
Now is the DUP's Arlene Foster in her final days as leader of the party. The vast majority of its elected members have signed a letter of no confidence. We are joined by columnist and commentator Alex Kane. Alex, the party issued a statement saying they weren't saying anything. Do you think it's over for her?
Morning, Audrey. Yes, I think it is over, and I think it's also been coming for some time. The huge, almost avalanche of problems within the DUP over the past 2 or 3 years, going back to their deal with the Conservatives over Brexit. They've had one crisis after another, and a breaking point was bound to have been reached. And I think the breaking point for this one is a sudden realisation, because some people think this is just a faction of the party going after Arlene. This is actually the entire party across all wings, the evangelical wing, the liberal wing, the moderates, the traditionalists, because they've suddenly got the collective fear with an assembly election just a matter of months away that they are going to take a hit. And basically, it's one of the old things. It's now the members and the candidates rallying together to find the best outcome and the best leader to minimise or completely eradicate the potential hits.
But Alex, how would a new leader do that, given that the factors which have arguably led the DUP to here are outside of their control at this point?
Oh, well, I think that's the key question, Audrey, and I'm not sure a leader, any leader can, because I think that the problems facing the DUP are so enormous right now. It's ironic, it goes back, some of your listeners may know, Arlene used to be a member of the Ulster Unionist Party, and she left the Ulster Unionist Party in January 2004 because it was going through precisely the same crisis that the DUP is now. And this was inevitable. The DUP was always a small, almost bit player party, suddenly became a big tent party, more and more wings and factions. And when you get a party like that, which faces challenges, it inevitably turns in on itself. And I cannot think there. Maybe Geoffrey Donaldson, Gavin Robinson, who's probably not known to many of your listeners, but the MP for East Belfast, Edwin Poots, well-known DUP MLA. Those are the names in the frame. But if you're asking me, Audrey, is any one of those, either singly or even in some sort of dream team, capable of rallying the party together and overcoming and papering over all the cracks and maximising the vote? I'm not sure that's possible at this stage.
Yeah, and that vote is critical. And you mentioned there the possibility of an election. And I'm wondering if the DUP have been moving to the right in recent times to see off the impact of Jim Allister's traditional unionist voice party, but in the process perhaps have lost younger voters to the Ulster Unionists or to the Alliance Party. Could they be looking at the position of Deputy First Minister in the next Stormont?
Well, they could, and I think that as it goes back to my original point, I think that is what's galvanised them at the moment, because again, back in 2017, when there was the unexpected assembly election, the Ulster Union, now the Unionists, lost the majority in the assembly for the first time ever. You have to go back to 2021 coming up to their centenary year, they suddenly found themselves in a minority in an assembly. That was bad enough. If 4 years down the line, they were suddenly to find themselves in a situation where it was Sinn Féin got first pick of the First Minister's office. That, you know, if you think things are bad now for the DUP, Audrey, just magnify and amplify that 10 times, because it's not just political electoral damage for unionism. This is major psychological damage, that sudden realisation after 100 years almost that they may be on the losing side of history. And there are things that can be done, there's things that need to be done, but whether or not they have the time to do them, or whether or not they really fully understand the problem and the dilemma they face is something we can't know at this point.
Yeah, we're told if she steps down as First Minister, under the rules, the DUP has 7 days to nominate someone to take her place. And if they don't, the executive falls and there has to be an election. Do you think there could be an early election?
I'm not convinced of that for a number of reasons. I think what's the 7 day thing, if Arlene now stands, the decision will be made in the next 24 hours. We will know it. I suspect she's not going to contest the leave. Again, if she stands down as First Minister, I think it'll be part of the choreography. They won't need the 7 days. A replacement will be put in. We've seen this happen before. She herself was Peter Robinson's replacement, in the same way that Reg MP had been David Trimble's replacement. Done in a matter of hours, this person will be told you hang on for the next few days. So I don't think it's in the DUP's interests at this moment, particularly with Boris Johnson, who has done them no favours and will do them no favours. They do not want a situation where an election which they could lose is on the way, or direct rule, which under Boris Johnson. I think all of my instincts, Audrey, and I could be wrong, but all of my instincts suggest that the DUP want a reasonably soft landing now. They do not want to go into a, you know, meltdown at assembly or executive level. They don't want to be pushed into an election because, put bluntly, they are not, at this moment, they are not prepared. They are not ready to have an election. They don't have a leader, and they don't have a clear strategy for what they need to do. They want a leader, and they want 6, 7, 8 months to build that strategy, to reach out to people who've gone to the TUV, the more right-wing element of unionism, to reach back into the moderates who've gone into Alliance and the Ulster Unionists. That can't be done in a matter of weeks. That will take months at minimum.
Great to have you on as always, Alex. Thank you very much, Alex Kane, columnist and commentator, joining us live from Belfast.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And coming through loud and clear at 8:39 is Damien O'Mara.
Here's hoping. Anyway, thanks, Audrey. Good morning to you again. It's soccer to start, where Chelsea will carry an away goal into the second leg of the UEFA Champions League semi-finals after drawing 1-1 with Real Madrid last night. Christian Pulisic gave them the lead in the 14th minute in Madrid. Real's Karim Benzema equalised 15 minutes later. The sides will play the return leg this day week at Stamford Bridge, while Paris Saint-Germain host Manchester City in the first leg of their semi-final kickoff at 8 o'clock tonight. Stan Kroenke, the majority shareholder at Arsenal, has moved to refute suggestions that he is open to selling the club. Arsenal were amongst the six English Premier League clubs who last week withdrew from plans for the breakaway European Super League. Former players Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira have joined a bid to buy the club, which has been fronted by the Spotify chairman Daniel Ek. There was a Grade 1 treble as part of a five-timer for Willie Mullins on the opening day of the Punchestown Festival yesterday. Chacon Pour-Soit justified favouritism in the Champion Chase. Culreevy was a surprise winner of the Champion Novice Chase, with Echoes in the Rain first home in the Champion Novice Hurdle. After victory in the Champion Chase, it means Paul Townend now leads Rachel Blackmore by 5 wins in the race for the Jockey's title. The Gold Cup is by any shadow the standout of the 3 Grade 1 races up for decision today. Now, after the withdrawal through injury of the Henry de Bromhead trained Manella Indo on Monday, just 6 horses will contest the race. 4 of those are trained by Willie Mullins, including the current favourite Alm Boom Photo. Clandey's Oboe, which is co-owned by Alex Ferguson and trained by Paul Nichols, was supplemented for the race last week and is the only Irish runner, one indeed of a limited number of English runners this week. Sam Twiston Davis is about to depart Heathrow for Dublin. He takes the ride on Clandey's Oboe in place of the injured Harry Cobb. Compton and a man very happy that a prime ride has fallen into his lap.
Oh, yes. To come over to Punchestown with a live chance is incredibly exciting, you know. Obviously, a lot of the times, it's our season is quietening down, and I'd be sat at home watching it and kind of envy of what would be going on. So to be going over there with a chance is a dream.
There was so much talk in advance about Manella Indo and the run that Henry de Bromhead in particular has been on. The withdrawal on Monday, does it blow the race wide open today?
It does. So obviously, Album Photo is still an incredibly good horse. He's going to take all the beating, but Plan de Zobo was very impressive at Aintree. He's in a really good place, so going to go over there, try our best, and hope for a bit of luck. Obviously, as he's a King George winner, you know he likes obviously right-handed tracks, but he's in a really good place mentally, so go and give it our best.
Yeah, so Punchestown, the nature of that right-handed track, it is somewhere that you would expect will suit him.
Well, I really do hope so. He was back a couple of seasons ago. He's brilliant round Down Royal. He's a good second there, so he's got a bit of form like that. So, hey, we'll go and see what we can do.
Can I just ask you, the perception, maybe rightly or wrongly, for people is that these trainers, these owners, they can write a cheque and they can supplement a horse at the top end of racing relatively easily. But how much greater a challenge is that now in a world of COVID? Because presumably the logistics of bringing jockeys and horses across the Irish Sea is much more significant than it once was.
Yes. So obviously we've had to do obviously a lot of paperwork, a lot of cheques, and you have to have your COVID test within 72 hours of the race, and then you obviously have to pass the health checks when you're over, so there's a lot of hoops to jump through. But even more so for an owner's side of it, they're supplementing a horse technique, they're not actually going to be able to come and watch live, so that must be quite a tough decision for everyone. But at the same time, it's the awe of kind of Punchestown. It is definitely one you want to be taking part in.
How long has the horse had to be over in advance?
He left Sunday night, so he'd arrived early Monday morning. And he seems to have settled in well.
Your season obviously officially came to a halt last weekend in England, but this is a very significant opportunity for you to round it off with a very, very big win.
That's it, and Punchestown is obviously a huge occasion and just a great way to kind of end what has been obviously a tricky year with COVID. We've been blessed obviously to be back racing, but it would be a dream.
Has it changed your enjoyment or the experience for you as being a jockey? Obviously, people are sick of us talking about the lack of crowds, but are you more aware of what sport means to the people that are so invested in watching these great animals run week in, week out?
Yeah, I guess being a jockey, the one thing is you never lose your appetite for wanting to win. So the races itself, you're still incredibly competitive and you're still incredibly hungry and want to do well. But the atmosphere itself, when you're walking to and from a paddock or to a weighing room, it is very odd. So it has been a tough year for everyone, but hopefully now we've given plenty of reasons for people to keep investing in the sport, cheering us on, and hope to see where we go in the future.
Sam, wish you well. Get around safely, and I suppose I best be impartial. So instead of saying good luck, I'll say may the most deserving horse and jockey win. Thanks so much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
That's Sam Twiston Davis. Racing starts at 3:40 today. Coverage on RT2 television from 4 o'clock. The Leinster captain Jonathan Sexton will miss Sunday's Heineken Champions Cup semi-final against La Rochelle. He'll continue through the return to play protocols. He underwent a HIA against Exeter 3 weeks ago. That match is live on Sunday Sport this weekend. The Irish hockey squad were beaten yesterday 3-1 by Great Britain. The sides meet in the second of four non-capped matches at 6 o'clock this evening. Both are Olympic qualified, both preparing for Tokyo. Nat Noah Wynn and Rachel Darrow recorded victories yesterday on the opening day of the European Badminton Championships and in the World Snooker Championship quarterfinals. Neil Robertson and Kyron Wilson tied 8 frames apiece ahead of the resumption of play at 10 o'clock this morning. Mark Selby leads Mark Williams 6-2. Anthony McGill will resume 9-7 up on Stuart Bingham. Judd Trump and Sean Murphy tied 4 all those matches, the best of 25. And sports news available throughout the day on the RTE News app and also on the RTE Sport website.